For decades, Steve Jobs was considered a legendary innovator in business and technology, a countercultural figure who'd created one of the biggest and most profitable companies in the world, and books and films about Jobs portray him as a visionary and a genius. But what Alex Gibney's latest documentary reveals is that Jobs was a genius at many other things as well, like manipulating public perceptions about him and his company, while engaging in some unsavory practices both at Apple and in his personal life. The film Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine Plaza, or Lincoln Plaza, I guess.
Both.
Sunshine, the Lincoln Plaza, and appropriately on iTunes. And I'm very pleased that it brings Alex Gibney and Fortune Magazine's Peter Elkind, who's written extensively about Apple, to our show today. Welcome, both of you.
Delighted to be here.
Good here.
Alex, one scene that you keep returning to in the film is the outpouring of grief from the public after Steve Jobs died. Why do you think that people felt so connected to him?
It's a question that I can't say I answer definitively, but it's what drove me to make the movie. I think one of the reasons is that he had this genius for understanding how important it was to connect us to these devices, computers, and then ultimately these mobile devices and smartphones. And that, I think, and he was the personification of Apple for so long, so that when he was gone, we both were afraid that those products weren't going to keep coming, and we missed the character who had been our guide for so long.
And can you think of any other business leader who people felt a similar connection to?
No.
Peter, Joe Nocera of the New York Times says that whenever he wrote a story critical of Apple, he would get a lot of hate mail. Did that ever happen to you?
Well, I did get some hate mail after I wrote a long story about Steve Jobs, but I mostly got hate from Steve Jobs, and as did my magazine, simply because it dared to assign a writer to write about Steve Jobs who Steve hadn't known and approved.
And Apple would come down hard on the press when it did something that they disapproved of. There's a story of a guy who found a prototype for an iPhone on a bar stool and then wrote about it and wound up being investigated by the police.
More than investigated, he had his door broken down by what you might even think of as a kind of a SWAT team that was part of this multi-jurisdictional investigative force. And this was after he had returned the phone, and they confiscated all of his computers and so forth and so on. So it was a pretty brutal display of power.
A message to journalists, don't mess with us?
I think so.
You say in the film that you were one of those people who had to have an iPhone.
I did. I mean, when it first came out, I remember I got one early, and I took it over to England, and I was showing it around like I had, you know, Frodo's ring or something like that. I mean, I really was entranced by it.
I was interested in the early days when it was announced. A lot of news articles said, well, Nokia is ahead, and so many other manufacturers of phones, Magnavox, et cetera, were ahead, and this isn't going to be anything special. And almost immediately, people perceived that it wasn't like everything else.
The iPhone was so engaging, and that was the genius of Steve Jobs, or one of his, you know, enormous talents. He created devices that we felt very personally, that we engaged with, that were user-friendly, that were very comfortable to use.
And Al Gore said Jobs was the first person who created technology products that people love. I can't believe that's totally true.
Well, I think it is true in part, but I think that, you know, if you look just before the iPhone, I think the really important device was the iPod. And what was genius about the iPod was that it wasn't about a device that you used to listen to music. It said to you, here's a device that holds all of my music. It was an extension of you. And I think that was the philosophy then extended to the iPhone. And that's what made, I think, Steve's products different.
Although these are all extensions of other things. The iPod is an extension of the Walkman.
Sure.
The iPhone is the
But the way he sold it to us was different. I mean, 1,000 songs in your pocket. It was genius that way.
This story has been told many times before, but perhaps we should do a brief recap of Apple history. How did Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak meet?
They were, childhood
friends.
That's right.
Yeah. Steve Wozniak is a little older, but they met early.
And Steve Wozniak was really the engineering genius.
And their first business venture, one of Jobs' selling points was sticking it to the man. What did he mean by that?
Well, they helped to make blue boxes together. And blue boxes were these devices that allowed you to essentially get on long-distance networks for free at a time when we all had long distance and when it was terribly expensive. It was illegal, mind you, but these were devices that were sticking it to the man.
Peter, hadn't Jobs and Wozniak collaborated on creating games for Atari?
They did. They worked together there, and there's a tale in the film which has been which Wozniak talked about very painfully, where Steve Jobs got paid for doing freelance work, and he said he was
game called Breakout.
Yes, and said he was giving Steve Wozniak half the money from it. It turned out that he actually got paid far more than he gave to Steve Wozniak.
And was Wozniak aware of that? Because they kept on collaborating.
He became aware of it, and he described it as being a very painful experience.
Because he said he would have given Steve the money if he wanted it, but the idea that Steve was so dishonest to him that he gave him a small pittance of what it actually deserved, but if it was about the money, he would have given it to him.
You interviewed Bob Belleville, the former director of engineering on the Macintosh. What did he have to say about working with Jobs?
Bob Belleville maybe is the heart of the film because we asked him to read his sort of personal eulogy for Jobs, and he broke down crying any number of times as he started to read it. And he both felt tremendous affection for Jobs and felt that Jobs had pushed him to his greatest work, and yet he also said that Jobs and the workload cost him his wife and his kids in terms of being driven from them. So he weeps both for his affection for Jobs and at the pain Jobs caused him.
One of the Apple's first Macintosh computers was named Lisa Peter. That's another messy story, isn't it?
It is a messy story. When Jobs had a child out of wedlock with his high school girlfriend, Chris Ann Brennan, named Lisa, and for a very long time he denied paternity of the child. In fact, went so far as to state in court that he was sterile and infertile and incapable of having a child and would pay no child support, and only after got sued by the state. She was on welfare, by the way. She was supporting her child on welfare, his child on welfare, at a point when he was worth $200 million. It's only when after he got sued by the state that he agreed to pay $500 a month in child support.
And it surprised me because he was an adopted child. You would have thought that he would have been more supportive of a child of his own.
You would have thought. But these issues of paternity keep coming back again and again with Steve. And I think the interesting thing about his character as an adopted child is he both felt a really deep-seated anger at having been rejected, but his adopted parents really doted on him, and so he felt both simultaneously angry and entitled, which I think is a key to his character.
Although later he discovered that his sister, the product of his birth parents, is one of America's best writers, so
Mona
he must
Simpson.
Have also felt proud. Did he ever have a relationship with Lisa, his daughter?
He did. Over time, they came to have an relationship. She went and lived with him for a couple of years in high school. And she writes very movingly about their relationship, which had its ups and downs throughout his life in the film.
We're talking about Alex Gibney's latest film, Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine, which opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine and the Lincoln Plaza. Alex is here along with Peter Elkind, who has written extensively about Jobs and Apple for Fortune magazine. One of the legends of Apple is that when Jobs came back after starting Pixar and Next, he brought the company back from the dead. Is there truth to that?
Sure. Apple was in bad shape. It had a very strong niche following for its computers, but it was not doing well and really required an infusion of money from Bill Gates, of all people, and Microsoft to keep it going.
So it could have gone the way of Betamax?
It is not impossible. It definitely could have, yes.
But
it was doing too many products, and they weren't hitting well.
They were days away from bankruptcy.
But the film also suggests that Fred Anderson played a major role in the comeback.
I think what's true is that there was a team of people who were already at Apple when Steve came back, who were a very powerful force, a kind of dream team for allowing the company to come back. So it wasn't just – I think the legend is that Steve came back, he gave the orders, and everything was fine. There was a very strong team in place once Steve came back.
And he recognized it. I mean, he privately worked very hard to preserve that team. He recruited some great people. He brought them over from Next in a couple of cases, several cases. But in public, he was the entire show.
I've always wondered why Next didn't make it. Was it an inferior product?
It wasn't. It was a product that was out of tune with the marketplace. It was too expensive, too complicated, and was targeting a very narrow audience.
Didn't Fred Anderson get largely blamed later in the stock backdating scandal at Apple?
Yes.
What happened there?
He did. Steve basically threw him under the bus. He was the CFO of Apple and had done Herculean work in terms of keeping the company alive and then helping turn it around. And he and Nancy Heinen, the general counsel of the company, were the ones who basically took the fall in the stock option backdating scandal. What was extraordinary is that Fred Anderson, when he settled with the SEC on some with a relatively minor fine and charges, issued a statement saying Steve Jobs had been entirely aware of the implications of what they were doing.
And Steve Jobs denied that.
Yes.
And stock backdating is they gave him the stock option and then claimed that they had given it to him earlier when it was a lot cheaper?
That's part of it. It's okay to backdate stock options. It's not okay if you do it and you don't report it properly, because then you're cheating the shareholders of the company.
Why didn't Jobs receive any blame in the end?
It's a good question. We were able, thanks to Peter, to find this videotape of Jobs' video deposition before the SEC. And it's interesting just how conciliatory the SEC is toward Jobs. And I think both the board and the SEC backed off because Jobs was so important and so powerful. That's my view.
Another pivotal moment was the unveiling of the iPhone. You interviewed Andy Grignon, is that his name?
Yes.
Senior manager of the phone. What was his take on it?
In terms of?
What it was going to do well. He decided to leave Apple for Palm.
Oh, yes. Well, Andy's description of his exit interview with Steve is very striking. It's a little bit like an exit interview with Vito Corleone. And because Steve begins to talk about how happy he was to have had him in his family, and Apple is a family. But then he said, if you so much as take one member of my family with you, I will personally take you out.
Now, this is not the image that we generally got of Steve Jobs. Was it because the press was handling him with kid gloves?
Well, a lot of it unfolded in private and became known only later. And it is also because he was so skillful at identifying himself with Apple's great products, and people didn't see beyond that.
So when Apple was investigated by Congress for its offshore tax accounts, did Congress find any wrongdoing?
No illegality, but I think what was troubling to Congress was that Apple presented itself so forcefully as an American company and yet managed to shelter most of its income, including its income from its American operations, overseas in Ireland so that it didn't pay any taxes.
How much of the money was offshore?
A lot.
We're talking about
billions and billions of dollars. I mean, that's
most successful corporation in the world right now. Is
yes,
it?
And Apple's not alone in following this practice. I mean, this is one of those cases where the scandal isn't what's illegal; it's what's legal.
Hmm. Now, do you think that Apple has become a different company since Steve Jobs died?
Somewhat.
The watch strikes me as a bit of a dud, but is it a success?
Well, I think the jury's out on that at this point. Tim Cook has definitely taken Apple in some different directions. He's come out as a gay man himself. He's clearly got more of a social conscience than Steve Jobs did, who had a very limited view of his personal role and a company's role in making the world a better place. So I think Apple's already headed in some different directions that way. Steve Jobs did have some duds, in fairness. But Tim Cook definitely has a different tone at the top.
And one of the other things you deal with in the film is the situation at Foxconn in China, where some workers actually committed suicide. How aware do you think the people at Apple were of the terrible conditions there? They must have gone and visited the plant.
Well, here's the instructive thing about Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs went to Japan a lot. He loved Japan. But even though all of these Apple products are manufactured in China. Steve Jobs didn't go to China once. And it's also instructive in that there was a very interesting Chinese activist who was trying to bring all sorts of tech firms, not just Apple, and make them aware of the environmental damage they were causing and also the unfair labor practices. All of the companies were willing to hear Ma Jun out, all except one. That was Apple. And it was only after Steve Jobs resigned, owing to ill health, that Apple actually engaged with Ma Jun.
So initially, they just ignored it. They didn't react at all to the suicides.
Well, we have a conversation of Steve Jobs reacting to the suicides in a business conversation with Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, and he says he's clearly upset by them. But then he goes on to say, well, actually, as a percentage, it's not that big a deal.
So what do you hope people will come away from your film with, that even our greatest heroes have clay feet?
I think it's more than that. I think that Steve Jobs presided over the creation of machines which have, in fact, changed our lives and have become extensions of ourselves. And I think it's important for us, you know, when these corporations get so big, at times when our governments are withering, you know, that we take account of their values. And number two, that we pay more attention to what these machines are doing to us.
Just one more thing. In the beginning of the film, we see a very young Steve Jobs on camera. He's clearly very shy. I was curious where that clip came from and whether he did change a lot over his life, or was he always the Steve Jobs that we've been talking about?
I think by and large, what changed about Steve is not his character, but that he got more power.
My great thanks to Peter Elkind, who has written about Apple and Steve Jobs for Fortune magazine, and to Alex Gibney, whose latest film is Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine. It opens this Friday at the Landmark Sunshine, the Lincoln Plaza, and also on iTunes. It's been a pleasure having both of you back.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.